Welcome, listeners, to Connect with Us. I'm Allison Rose Levy, here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a Huffington Post and alternate blogger, a best-selling writer, and a longtime journalist of health, food, and the environment. Every week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between your personal health and well-being and our total health environment, the health of our communities, the health of our food, water, air, and earth, the health of our society, and the health of our global ecology. Each week on Connect the Dots, I talk with different authors, experts, thought leaders, advocates about all of the different facets of reality that intertwine to create and promote health, or not, as the case may be. This week's show is really fascinating to me. I fell in love with the book, and I'm so happy to have its author on our show today. His name is Oliver Berkman. He's a feature writer for The Guardian. He's won the Foreign Press Association's Young Journalist Award of the Year and has also been shortlisted for the Orwell Prize. His book, which I just totally love, and it's called The Antidote, Happiness for People Who Can't Stand Positive Thinking. And as regular listeners of this program know, I really look at not only the things in our world that are undermining health and well-being and the ecology of our planet, but also at the attitudes and ways that we carry and the things that serve as obstacles to our coming to grips with that. So it should be pretty apparent why this book interests me so much. And I'm delighted to welcome Oliver Berkman. Welcome to Connect the Dots.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
One of the, just to kind of segue a little bit from my kind of statement introducing you, one of the things that seems like really serves as an obstacle to grappling with some of the incredible challenges of our time and of our society, is that we're coming at some things that are happening in our world that are pretty disturbing and challenging and actually dangerous if we're talking about things like climate change, which I cover on this show. And yet the overall philosophy or psychological understanding with which we kind of approach such realities is so often based on, let's just look at the positive. That alone is, if we look at anything negative, we are somehow creating it. Let's just look at the bright side. And while obviously, people are fearful of sadder feelings, angry feelings, and other kinds of feelings, my sense has always been that just looking on the bright side is really, can be an act of denial and not really very helpful. I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think it's an excellent point. I mean, the thing I try to sort of start from in the book is the idea that there's something about focusing on positivity all the time that brings about bad effects, that trying so hard to be happy makes life feel miserable, that trying to convince ourselves that everything can only ever work out for the best is actually a bad way to actually achieve success. And I think that you raise a really good point. We feel at the moment like we're facing all these sort of major, very serious negative situations, and that the philosophy of positive thinking is ill-suited to addressing them. In a sense, I think, all the way through history, people have faced extremely serious problems. It's just that for the last sort of century or so, and maybe it's been a sort of exceptional century, when the positive thinking ideology has flourished, maybe we have not had to confront, truly global scale, world level things like climate change, but and so in certain pockets of the privileged West, during that time, a philosophy can flourish that just involves saying that everything's fine and going to get better. But I just think, it's not reality, and it's not just a sort of message of despair that says, well, face up to the fact that things are awful. It's actually a much more fruitful way of finding real, genuine, sustainable happiness in those difficult contexts, if you don't insist on a philosophy of happiness that denies half of what's actually going on in the world.
So it's actually more holistic, really, is what you're saying.
Right, that's one word for it. I mean, I think all I'm trying to suggest in this book is that there are a lot of ideas, many of them going back a long way in philosophy, back to the Stoics in Greece and Rome or the Buddhist tradition, whatever it might be, that are a lot more powerful than the kind of very specific kind of positive thinking that has dominated the field of popular psychology in America and to a certain extent elsewhere for the last century or so. There's now a lot of evidence from research findings that, for example, repeating positive affirmations to yourself can make some people feel worse, or that visualizing successful completion of your goals sometimes make you less motivated to achieve them. So all these kind of techniques that we feel like we know from self-help and everything can have these really problematic effects. And the moment you reach back further in philosophy, you find a much, much more welcoming and, yes, I think holistic stance towards the fact that, you know, the human emotional repertoire has a negative side as well as a positive side, and it's not a, it's not very fruitful to pretend otherwise.
What are some of the negative effects that you're describing? Can you, can you kind of go into that a little, because, I mean, the notion is if we only focus on positive things, there will only be positive effects. And yet you say that studies and other things show that there can be negative effects from doing that. Can you go into that a little bit for our listeners?
Absolutely. I think there's two obvious levels to address that, the personal and the societal. On the personal level, it all goes back, in a way, to this analogy with the game where you challenge somebody to not think about a polar bear for a minute, you know? As soon as you try to not think about a polar bear, all you can think about is polar bears, whereas if someone hadn't even raised the topic, you would happily have not thought about a polar bear for a minute or two. There's something very fundamental to the way the human mind works that focusing relentlessly on not doing something, such as having a negative thought or feeling stressed or whatever, brings about that thing. And many studies have now backed this up. People who are bereaved and try not to feel grief have a harder time getting over grief than people who let themselves feel it. People who, in studies, you know, are told about it and make a sad event in the news and then told not to feel sad about it later on, end up feeling sadder about it. So this same dynamic keeps going all the way through personal psychology, this idea that actually we need to sometimes learn to just be with negative emotions and try, instead of trying to stamp them out, because when you stamp them out, all you can do is focus on whether there's any stray negative emotions that you need to stamp out. Then on the societal level, I think I pick up to some extent on things that the social critic Barbara Ehrenreich has brilliantly written about, suggesting that, for example, the current financial crisis that we're still feeling the aftershocks from is something that, you know, that may have been partly brought about by the fact that lots of people thought that as long as they were convinced everything was going to succeed, then it definitely would. And if you're an investment banker whose corporate culture is to say, just as long as we all believe, then this new financial instrument is going to be fine, you can see very quickly how that's going to land people in problems. It's going to become taboo at meetings at the top of major investment banks to sort of put your hand up and say, hang on, I think this is going to go badly wrong. So on both levels, the personal and the societal, I think there's a real problem with that sort of relentless focus on optimism and positivity, which is not to say that, you know, some optimism isn't a good thing in life, but it's all a question of finding the balance.
What, in the course of your sort of research, well, let's just start at the beginning. I mean, what led you to look into this? Why were you, interested in investigating this? You're British by background, is that right?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, when you, you reside in the United States and, you're here and all of that, I mean, do you see, was it more noticeable to you, as an English person living in the States, that this is kind of an attitude that Americans sort of have adopted, and that's kind of a bit of a standout? I mean, what was your perception concerning
that? I think there is certain, I mean, that wasn't the very origin of this, was that I read a column in The Guardian about psychology in general, and after doing it for a few years, I had realized that, you know, there were some things that a lot of the good approaches seemed to have in common, and a lot of the unhelpful approaches seems to have in common, and it's really that distinction between whether you relentlessly focus on positive activity at all costs, or whether you find a way of admitting living alongside negative feelings and situations. So that was the very origin. But but yeah, in, it's very clear as a Brit in America, I think, that it is especially American thing. I come from the north of England, you know, a place where people who, if you meet someone in the street who's just sort of smiling, you'd be instantly suspicious because we're all gloomy, pessimists up there. But it's not. I mean, New York again is a bit different. I think a lot of people in New York City, where I live, are plenty suspicious of this kind of positivity. Mm-hmm. But no, it is a big industry in the States. It's a big industry everywhere to some extent now. But when, for example, I was researching this book, I went to a huge motivational seminar in Texas called Get Motivated. That's really the pinnacle, that kind of thing, of this approach that I'm talking about and critiquing. So in a way, yes, it's very useful to be based here. That said, a lot of the most interesting psychology and spiritual writing from the other side of the spectrum is also coming from the United States. So in general, it's a very interesting place for me to be.
You know, talk a little bit about what you would describe as the negative path. In other words, in your book, you not only say, well, this is unproductive and not all it's cracked up to be, because when you suppress half of reality, it kind of doesn't go away. It sort of bounces back on you. Mm-hmm. It's there all along to begin with. But then you also, in the book, counsel kind of going that there is a different path, and that, you know, we have this misperception that this is the path and the only way. And, you know, but you're also positing that there is another way, a different path. So could you describe that a little bit?
Certainly, yes. I mean, I didn't want this book to be a sort of just a demolition of something that I disagreed with, because that's not fun to read apart from anything else. So after that sort of first chapter where I admit, take a lot of enjoyment in dismantling all the things that don't work about positive thinking, I do move on to, I suppose it's a family of approaches that I group under this title of the negative path to happiness. It's not a question of follow these three steps and everything will be okay, but then I think, you know, that's really part of what I'm arguing against. So, for example, one of those traditions that I mentioned just before is Stoicism. The ancient Greek and Roman Stoics had this technique that I love that they called the premeditation of evils, which was the idea that sometimes you should actually think about how badly things could go if you're worried about them, as a way of dispelling that worry and anxiety. There's a modern psychologists call this defensive pessimism. It's not a question of just being a downer and gloomy, but actually very practically dealing with concerns about the future, not by trying to persuade yourself that everything's going to go perfectly well, which is the positive thinking approach, but by saying, okay, rationally speaking, you know, exactly what would be the worst case scenario here? Partly because you will almost always realize that you were catastrophizing, and that actually the worst effects of the thing you fear are not as bad as you had been imagining. But secondly, you know, even if they are, you will be prepared in a way that is much more, I would say, sort of sustainable and stable, a way to go into the future. And it's because it's just so much effort to be constantly trying to replenish your reserves of conviction that everything's going to be fine. So, for example, another advantage of this that Seneca the Stoic liked to point out is that if you realize that the things you enjoy now, the relationships and the possessions that give your life meaning, if you realize you could lose them, and indeed, you know, in an ultimate sense, you are going to lose them, then you will also feel a much more appreciation for them and feel happier for that reason as well. If you look upon, you know, it's very easy to forget, as we know, that the lovely house you're privileged to live in, or the lovely relationship you're privileged to enjoy, it's very easy to become acclimatized and to sort of just take it for granted. And if you actually think about how badly things could go, you can find a sort of extra appreciation there from realizing that there is this dark side that will make you appreciate the lighter one all the more. So that's just one area of this, I also look at Buddhism and the benefits of thinking about failure and insecurity, and it goes on and on. But that's a sort of example, I guess, of what I'd say is the negative part.
Well, it actually does sound a bit close to Buddhist thought, you know, where, you know, everything can dissolve into nothingness. It's all... you know, subject, you know, there's much suffering in this world. I mean, in effect, it actually sounds a bit like a Buddhist view.
Right. Well, I mean, there's a lot of overlap between the Stoics and the Buddhists, even if not at the time of the origin. But and the focus of the sort of emphasis that I look at in the Buddhist section of this book is about meditation and other Buddhist approaches as a way of sort of resisting the urge to think positive. So I went on a week-long, almost silent meditation retreat to sort of experience what this was like. And as you may know, it's pretty hard work at first to try to calm your mind. But then you realize that actually trying to calm your mind is not really the point, and that... really, I think what you're developing in meditation is the capacity to be with whatever comes up, you know, including a lack of calm. There's something actually quite positive thinking-ish about believing that the point of meditation is just to become totally blissed out. It's actually more a question of, you know, treating your thoughts like the weather across the sky, being okay with negative things that arise, not being dragged around by them, but also not trying to deny that they sort of are going to arise and then pass away. So that sort of Buddhist idea of non-attachment, that you can be present, not you know, checking out of life or becoming a sort of passive person with no feelings, but that you don't need to be run by your feelings in quite the same way, is, I think, very powerful. And exactly the opposite of positive thinking, because the funny thing is that actually a real positive thinking approach is about making yourself be more run by your feelings and connecting, forging that bond ever more strongly between how you feel and how you act. There's something really powerful about realizing that you don't need to feel like doing something in order to do it, that it's okay to feel pessimistic or anxious about something and to go and do it anyway. I certainly wouldn't have got this book written if I hadn't figured out that I didn't need to feel really enthusiastic about writing every morning before I could do some writing.
Yeah, also there's a sense with positive thinking that, I mean, one of my kind of objections to it has been the sense that the notion that one can program oneself, you know, in other words, if I want an outcome, then I can, you know, not be vulnerable to the feeling of wanting an outcome, working for an outcome, knowing that an outcome, you know, in case of Americans, the outcome is always success. You know, for me, I might define that as getting a handle on climate change, so that the world can be maintained for human life, you know, rather than personal success. But whatever the outcome one desires is, the sense that somehow it is ultimately attainable by any act of personal will, I mean, which is not to say one doesn't put in a good effort or whatever, but the notion that we as individuals are so powerful that, you know, through personal will, we can, if we just program ourselves correctly, we can attain any outcome. And, you know, what is that? And also, what about all of the other people who may be wishing for a different outcome?
Actually, these are all excellent points. I mean, there's something so weird, apart from anything else, in the idea that you can, when it comes to sort of changing yourself, that you can sort of stand back from yourself and then decide, well, okay, self one is going to decide that self two is going to have these characteristics. Obviously, you're completely enmeshed in the person being changed. You can't sort of get outside of yourself in that sense. And then secondly, it brings to mind that wonderful idea in the philosophy of yoga about not being attached to the fruits of your actions, that really your job, your responsibility, whatever your views of success, you're right, you know, is to put in the process and put in the time and the effort. And if you possibly can, not to be hugely invested in whether any individual instance of that sort of works out perfectly. Mm-hmm. This comes in the book into my whole sort of argument against fixating too much on goal setting. I think another thing that we're really, really into, especially in corporate world
fixating
today.
On what? Fixating
goal setting, on making, on formulating very ambitious goals and then sort of putting all your energies into trying to achieve them. When you look at some of the most sort of productive and interesting artists and authors and others through history, they don't sort of stand in front of a mirror and clench their fists and say, I'm going to write a great American novel, or I'm going to produce mm-hmm. something this amazing. They have these process goals. They say this many hours a day, this many words a day. They take questions of value out of it. It's not I'm going to write the best 300 words I can or something. It's just 300 words. And, you know, you will get a lot done that way. And the artist Chuck Close famously said, inspiration is for amateurs. The rest of us just show up and get to work. And there's something really powerful in that, in just trying as best you can to detach from the outcome and realizing that your only responsibility is to do what you can, whether it ends in success or terrible for you.
Yeah, this is a big conversation in the, you know, environmental community because, you know, how do we keep working toward putting a brake on the carbon and methane emissions that are accelerating climate change?
Right.
And what happens if we don't? What are we looking at? And how do we maintain a kind of hopeful attitude? In fact, I've just been involved in a whole dialogue with some folks about this exact issue. And you know, and there's this also, I mean, I would say a concomitant of the attitude, you know, the positive thinking is the sense that we somehow are entitled to or must always have hope. The fear that without hope, people will become passive, hopeless, despairing, run for antidepressants,
right.
You know, and not be able to, you know, in fact, face up to the current reality with whatever we are currently creating. And so, you know, there's a sense of always sort of, and this goes as well to, you know, publications and books I've written in the self-help field, and there's always a, you know, you can't identify a problem without saying what people can do. But then, you know, yeah. the kinds of things that people can do very often are the things that people wouldn't want to be doing because they'd rather just fix their minds on being successful, you know, in some kind of economic sense or, you know, whatever, with their personal goals. So, you know, the sense is that one must be able to do something, be able to be hopeful about doing something, but anything uncomfortable, you know, is reminding people of maybe a state of lack of empowerment or despair or, you know, social, you know, and global ill that they don't really want to be looking at because they can't individually necessarily fix it.
The psychology of climate change and is absolutely fascinating. I mean, you have these twin poles, don't you? You have on the one hand, everyone wants everything to be just as good as ever with no sacrifices. On the other hand, I think there's now quite a lot of evidence coming in that the environmental lobby has not helped itself by sort of painting total doomsday scenarios, even if
right.
they may be accurate, because yes. it causes people to throw up their hands and walk away. And I think, you know, that grayscale, that that idea that actually maybe what we need to do is that there is a chance of making a difference, that it won't mean that we don't have to change our lives radically, but that we don't need to only be dwelling on absolute doom and gloom or absolute perfection. I think that's all very much in tune with, you know, I don't really go into that too much in the book, but I think it's very much in tune with that outlook that we might be able to have a certain amount of hope while a certain amount of realism is there as well, instead of bouncing back and forth between, you know, it's all going to hell, or I'm just going to ignore it completely.
Well, we'll be continuing this discussion in the second half of our show. We're going into our break for station identification here in Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy talking with Oliver Berkman, the author of The Antidote. Stay with us for the second half of the show, and we'll be back. Welcome back, listeners, to the second half of Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. On today's show, I'm talking with Oliver Berkman, a journalist and author. He's the author of the new book, The Antidote, Happiness for People Who Can't Stand Positive Thinking. If you missed the first half of our show, please check it out in the Connect the Dots archives and like us on iTunes. Pass it along to other people and check out some of our other recent programs as well. If you'd like announcements about upcoming radio programs, please sign up on my Facebook page, Connecting the Dots for Health. So we are talking about the antidote, why positive thinking isn't always what it's cracked up to be and not as effective as we've been taught to hope or believe. You know, one of the things that we were talking about in the first half of the show, Oliver, was, you know, how to approach, you know, big picture issues like climate change, you know, without catastrophizing. But, you know, but while also, you know, being realistic or, you know, seeing what we have to do, whether, you know, without knowing the outcome. And so you mentioned the Buddhist practice of detachment and, you know, or dispassion. Maybe detachment maybe sounds like one is numb and schizoidal and sort of shut down. But, you know, with dispassion, you know, with a kind of conscious commitment to proceed without, with the uncertainty of knowing the outcome. In a way, you know, positive thinking is almost the fruit of the affluence that America has enjoyed and the Western world has enjoyed, often at the expense of other things, you know, over the preceding decades before we've, you know, recently had this, you know, kind of economic downturn in the last decade. You know, so it's kind of given us an idea that, you know, ever-expanding growth is possible. We're sort of entitled to everything. Anything that I want, I can create through my own mind. But, you know, even within that, I find a hidden anxiety, because it's kind of like, even though the affirmation or the view states, oh, you know, success is there to be yours at whatever you undertake, if you just program yourself correctly, the undertow is somehow, if you don't succeed and you topple off, you know, the American gravy train, you know, there's a sort of a deeper fear, understanding that you could be in very deep doo-doo, because we don't really have the social supports and caring values in place to catch people when that kind of thing happens, so that even as there are all of these, you know, kind of positive statements about all that we could attain and how successful we could be, there's an underlying realization that we could be in deep danger, you know, in deep trouble, if we don't, in fact, measure up in that way. And so one of the things that I really very much liked about your book, The Antidote, is you're frankly taking on the topic of failure. Can you sort of share with our listeners a little bit more about, you know, because that's kind of like almost like the, you know, the thing that nobody, that a lot of people are experiencing, but nobody wants to talk about in the public comments so much.
Right. I mean, there's so many different ways into this, but I'll just talk about one or two of them. One of the most entertaining reporting trips for this book was to go to a place that has become known as the Museum of Failed Products in Ann Arbor. They don't really like that term themselves these days, but it's a collection of consumer goods that have been established just by buying new items of whatever gets launched in the supermarkets. But as a result of that, most of them are failures, because the majority of such products do fail. And this really only exists as a viable business that product designers pay to come and look at, because that industry, like every industry, and I'd say all of us, is so averse to dwelling on failure the rest of the time. You know, they don't want to keep their own failures. They don't want to look too closely when they launch a product and it doesn't work out. And then 10 years down the line, they realize that actually they need to research what's been tried and failed. And so they end up at this place, which is sort of the most hilarious yogurt-based shampoos and pre-scrambled, microwavable scrambled eggs and all sorts of all sorts of fun stuff like that. Really two big reasons why it's a problem to be so averse to failure and ignore it. One is that we fail to understand properly what causes success because we don't look at the people who fail. You know, you can read any number of autobiographies by celebrity business people explaining how their willingness to take chances or their good humor or whatever it might be, you know, was the cause of their success. But you never know if there are maybe thousands of other people who tried the same things and failed because they don't get to write celebrity autobiographies. So that's something called the survivor bias. You know, we only hear from, even in quite serious scholarship, they really only tend to look at a lot of the time the successes rather than the failures. And so you can't know whether maybe it becomes very hard to attribute causality to a specific strategy or technique. There's a famous book called The Millionaire Mind, which basically explains that America's millionaires are actually very frugal. You might imagine they were high spenders, but actually they're very frugal. Well, that doesn't prove that being very frugal will make you a millionaire, because if the base you're starting from is sufficiently non-wealthy, then being frugal is just going to keep you, at your regular income without wasting money. The other big thing, I think, is that we're so allergic to that feeling of failure that it sort of, as you hinted at in your question before, you know, leads to an anxiety that is unhelpful. We feel that we are climbing this ladder, but actually what we're really scared of is slipping right back down to the bottom of the ladder. And what certainly many societies, America, I think, above all, but Britain increasingly, does not provide for the people who slide right back down to the bottom. And I think if you look at some of the happiest countries in the world based on surveys, you find that actually certain places in Northern Europe where they're rather better at this than either the Brits or the Americans, tend to be happier, not just because the very least fortunate people are supported to some degree, but because nobody, wherever they are on the ladder, has to worry about the absolute worst sort of destitution. And I think this then feeds into things even just like, there's this famous work now done by a psychologist called Carol Dweck in terms of raising children. And she shows that if you you praise children for their effort, then they will flourish because they will realize that what matters is trying. When they encounter failure, they will be okay with that. It will be evidence for them that they are pushing their boundaries. If you reward them and praise them for their attainments, then they will come to see that as a bar that they must always reach at minimum. And it will become a much more sort of fraught experience when they inevitably do encounter failure. And they may, in fact, become less risk-taking in what would have been a good way, push their boundaries less because they are so afraid of the fact that, you know, at some point when you push your boundaries, you fail at things. So I think there's a lot to be said for both in terms of how we understand the world and then in how we feel about it, in becoming significantly more sort of comfortable with this reality of failure, which is not to say it's easy, I think it's beneficial to the extent that we can.
You know, I also wonder, you know, as I hear what you're saying there, whether in fact the notion that, you know, with a positive attitude you can program yourself to attain whatever you want, whether that isn't actually a form of, you know, it appears to be helpful psychological advice, and we've talked about it. You know, you mentioned that within a psychological frame, in fact, you know, psychological findings show that that's not even really what's most helpful. Or in fact, it can be counterproductive. But the other thing I wonder is whether this isn't a form of social control, because the reverse side of that, you know, the positive side is, oh, you can succeed, anyone can do anything, we all could be a millionaire, if we just have a positive attitude. But the flip side of that is, and if you're not, it's because, it's your fault. It's because you didn't sufficiently do yadda 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 whatever it is, you know, kind of thing. And, you weren't positive enough, you allowed a negative thought to creep in. You know, talk a little bit, if you would, for our listeners about your experiences, you know, right at the sort of heart you know, the sort of positive thinking festivals or seminars or events that you've attended. You know, the people who are making a very good living through doing this, I think, are kind of cautionary tales. And also, is this a form of social control where, you know, it's your problem and it's your responsibility? Anyone could be a millionaire and enormously successful if they just knew, you know, did all the right things kind of thing. It doesn't have anything to do with opportunity, the social fabric, et cetera.
It's a great, great point. I mean, I think that above all, you know, if everybody is in a position of believing that they're entirely responsible for what happens to them, and especially that how they think is responsible is the cause of what happens to them, then, you know, they are less likely to be justifiably objecting or angry or whatever it might be to injustices, to sort of trying to fight structural problems that sort of partly account for the situation that they're in. I think when you go to those places like the Get Motivated seminar, I went to, you know,
what was the seminar? I just want you to say that more clearly.
It was called Get Motivated with an exclamation point. And the keynote speaker at the day that I went to was former President George Bush.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that he does now with his post-presidency, apart from painting pictures of dogs, as we discovered the other day, is to travel to things like this, explaining really his sort of life philosophy. And what I found very interesting about his life philosophy, you know, I'm sure there are plenty of people among your listenership who are no great fan of George W. Bush, but it actually doesn't matter what your view of his politics is. If you just listen to the philosophy that he outlines, which is basically that when things are going well, that proves that optimism is good. When things are going badly, you need more optimism. You know, you can see that that's a circular logic. whether the person saying it, you know, was trying to achieve goals from the left or the right, it's not really relevant to this particular point. It's a kind of self-reinforcing idea that never causes you to have to say, well, hang on, what if things don't go well? What if this fails? What if this venture doesn't lead to the outcome that I'm hoping for? So if you're in a position of power, I think it sort of insulates you from that. If you're in a position of not having power, then it really does sort of heap your burdens back upon yourself. Barbara Ehrenreich writes very, very movingly about her own experiences with breast cancer, and being in that sort of community of people going through that, where it's actually taboo to admit that you think what's happening is pretty terrible, and that you're not happy about it at all, and that actually, you know, the implication is that you should really look on the bright side at all times, and that actually it's going to have a big effect on your health outcomes. Now, there's lots of contentiousness about the evidence for that particular point, but what she really brings out is there's a big reason everyone seems to want people with serious illnesses to be happy, is it just makes it a lot easier for everyone else. You know, it's a lot less awkward if we don't have to gather around a close friend and let her or him be in pain and feeling hostility and feeling anger. It's a whole lot easier if that person just sort of smiles beatifically and we can all get on with our lives. There's a very sort of problematic way in which it's just sort of helpful for the rest of us if people who are going through awful things can just be all smiley about it. And I think we should be wary of that and realize that actually, you know, one of the most powerful ways you can be a friend to somebody is to let them be really down about certain things and let them be furious about things that are happening to them or upset about that.
You mentioned in the book that there, you know, there's a greater correlation between perfectionism and suicide rather than feelings of hopelessness and suicide. So, you know, the cultural myth would be, you're more at risk if you're hopeless than if you're striving for perfection. But, you know, if taking a measure like, you know, actual suicide, people who, you know, kind of hold too high a bar, you know, is implying for themselves are more at risk. I mean, can you tell us a little bit more about that? Because I think that relates to the point you're making here as well.
No, absolutely. Yeah. I think you need to use a careful definition of perfectionism there. I think a lot of people probably think of themselves as perfectionists. They just mean they like to do things well, you know. But yeah. but when it gets to a sort of pathological degree, that I mean, the basic difference, I think, is that if you are very, very obsessively perfectionist, then you are going to meet with overwhelming anxiety-producing challenges to that perfectionism all the time, because of the fact that the world isn't perfect. You know, the people, you are not going to do all the things you are demand of yourself, and people are not going to behave the way that you demand them to behave. The great psychotherapist Albert Ellis really zeroed in on this and talked about how important it was to try to change our demands about how the world should be into strong preferences. It's still fine to have a strong preference, but mm-hmm. other people behave a certain way. It really gets troublesome when it's a sort of black and white demand. And then on the other side, I'm certainly not suggesting that people who are seriously depressed should not seek help with that. I want to be very clear about that. But there is this phenomenon called depressive realism that suggests that very mildly depressed people, people with a certain downbeat approach to the world, actually have a more accurate perception of mm-hmm. Certain things in it than do the undepressed. There is a certain sort of stability and fluidity to having a sort of slightly downbeat take on things that I think, and along with the defensive pessimism idea that I was talking about earlier, that can all go together to be a very sort of fruitful and productive way forward. Certainly, you know, I think in sort of work context, if you're working on something with a team, it's extremely useful to have a pessimist or two on board alongside all the optimists, someone who is sort of his natural tendency is to sort of think through the way things might not work. In the audience at that motivational seminar in Texas, I got chatting to some service people, some lawyers, actually, they're military lawyers from because it was in San Antonio, big military town. And of course, they point out that refusing to think about failure, as we were being told to do from the stage, is absolutely the worst way to plan something a military undertaking, you know, regardless of the merits of this or that undertaking. If you want it to succeed, they employ, or they should anyway, employ, and in most cases do, teams of people whose job is to sort of think about all the different ways in which things could go wrong. So I think, it's really important to have some people who are capable of that kind of moderate pessimism and aren't either obsessive optimists or obsessive perfectionists on your team.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, I mean, for one thing, you know, to plan without a plan B, you know, I mean, at the very least, what you're, describing here is the ability to kind of plan for, you know, both the up and down side of anything. I mean, isn't one would think that would just be kind of realistic.
One of the things that gets in the way, I think, is this idea that I look at in the section on goals, that people bring the goal in to sort of define their personality. So mm-hmm. People don't want to countenance failure because of what that would signify in the psychological model that they've built up. It's not that they would have failed at something, it's that they would be a failure. Mm-hmm. There's a fascinating work by an American historian called Scott Sandich who argues that this idea of a person as a failure rather than as a specific activity as having failed is really very new, and it comes from the growth of consumer capitalism. It comes partly from he argues, a fascinating argument, comes partly from the growth of the credit ratings agencies. But, you know, as capitalism reaches this sort of consumer credit stage, it needs a way of rating people as a good bet or a bad bet. And a lot of the language we use today, like good for nothing, for example, comes originally from the language of credit rating and trying to work out whether banks should make loans to certain individuals or not. And that leads to this whole idea of failure as a global judgment on a person that I think is very gets into all sorts of problems. Yeah.
So we've actually internalized, kind of numeric quantification, which is a tool you know, in places where that's appropriate, like, you know, the economic realm, but because our society is so dominated by values of the economic realm, what you're in fact saying there is that we have internalized these numerical quantifications about ourselves.
Right. It's partly the numbers side of it, absolutely. And then it's partly the sort of global side of it. I think a global within a single person, I mean, you know, this idea that it's a judgment on the whole of you. And I think it's so much more powerful if possible. You know, this is also another problem with the idea of self-esteem. It's all to do with saying, well, I am a good person. That's clearly better than thinking I'm a bad person. But I think a lot of people, a lot of psychologists who I sort of think very well of would say that actually the right approach is to say, certain actions that I undertake are good and certain ones are bad, and we're best to undertake more good ones and fewer bad ones, but that is not a judgment on an entire personality.
Right, so one is keeping the personality, the essence of the person, the self of the person, is being kept free from their behavior, no matter how good or bad it might be, you know, kind of thing.
Right.
You know, that basically a priori kind of establishes the value of a human being, no matter what behavior, conditioning, life circumstances or whatever may have shaped that person, and, you know, what they do with that kind of thing. So I think that does actually, in some fundamental way, provide a better grounding, a more caring grounding for how we view ourselves and others. I don't know.
Right. No. Absolutely. To sort of be able simultaneously to value everybody and to accept yourself totally, but at the same time not to have to pretend that every single thing everyone does in the world is good, and to be able to condemn actions when we need to condemn them in ourselves and others without it having that sort of feedback effect of dehumanizing ourselves or others, I think it's definitely the way forward.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I think your topic is it's quite fundamental and important and needed, in a time like ours where, you know, all that's happening kind of comes at us fast and furious, and we sort of it's important to reevaluate underlying assumptions. So, for example, you know, the positive thinking that we're talking about, evolved during a more apparently beneficent time, although it may have had downside effects on others that we were unaware of. And as we kind of wake up to some of the harsher realities and what's coming down the line, it needs to be reevaluated to, you know, kind of how hardy it is, how, you know, what resilience it gives, what standing it gives us to face the time we're living in.
You're absolutely right. I mean, I don't, to be honest, focus to a huge degree in the book on these sort of environmental and societal level challenges, but I think it's a very perceptive point. It's all part and parcel of the of the same need and the same problems with the ways the philosophy of happiness that we've come to accept as normal.
Yeah, as a kind of right or something. Well, we're coming down to the end of the show, so I want to thank you so much, Oliver Berkman, for being my guest here today in Connect the Dots. And I want to recommend to all listeners your book, The Antidote, Happiness for People Who Can't Stand Positive Thinking. Please check it out, the whole show on iTunes, forward it to your friends, and come back next week, Wednesday, 10 a.m. Eastern Time, for another edition of Connect the Dots with me, Allison Rose Levy. Thanks so much, Oliver. Great to have you.